This is Bach Talk. No, this is not Bach.
Down by the Sally Gardens, my love and I did meet.
But there is a connection.
She walked the Sally Gardens on little snow-white feet.
I'll explain in a moment.
She bid me take life easy as the leaves grow on the tree.
For now, let's just enjoy.
But I young and foolish, with her did not agree.
He's a Bach specialist who sometimes finds himself outside the box.
By a tree by the river, my love and I did stand. And on my leaning shoulders, she placed her snow-white hand. She bid me take life easy as the grass grows on the weeds. But I was young and foolish, and now am full of tears.
The iridescent voice of tenor David Gordon. Outside the Box was the title of his most recent concert in Carmel, California. That was a track from that concert, the traditional folk song with words from the great Irish poet William Butler Yeats. Hello, I'm Ron Clem. Welcome to Bach Talk. By his own admission, David Gordon has always led parallel musical lives. For decades, he's been a distinguished classical music tenor soloist, who's made his mark with great opera companies and symphony orchestras around the globe. Here's some mind-boggling trivia. David made his United States concert debut at Powell Symphony Hall in 1972 with the Bach Society of St. Louis. These days, David no longer sings on the classical stage, but is still, as he says, quite securely strapped to his guitar. Drawing on a lifetime of concerts and centuries of music, David creates unique programs of songs and poetry interwoven with colorful historical narrative. Historical narrative, that's the aspect we want to focus on today. David Gordon is, perhaps above all else, an historian. And he's written a book that is so fascinating, so intriguing, the Bach Society has linked it to our own website. You'll want a copy for yourself, I'm sure. So while you listen to David and I talk about it, feel free to wander over to BachSociety.org, click on About, and there you'll find The Little Bach Book. We talked to tenor, author, historian, and friend David Gordon from his home in Pacific Grove, California.
I have always been a history buff, and I'm aware that very often we learn about history by learning the dates of battles and the names of kings. That's a kind of an overstatement, but it's not too far from the truth. And I've always been interested in how people lived in olden times. I grew up in a very beautiful area of southeastern Pennsylvania, north of Philadelphia, along the Delaware River, in beautiful Bucks County. And my grandparents lived right up the road in a house that was built in 1758. And there was just tons of 18th century revolutionary colonial history in the area where I grew up. And I became interested in daily life. How did they live? How did they cook? I'm sort of interested in that for all eras of history. And I began to, midway through my career, I began to receive invitations to give lectures on Bach and his music, particularly pre-concert lectures for people who are going to hear the music. And while I talk about the individual pieces of music, I began to insert vignettes of daily life that I hoped would give people a greater appreciation for what Bach had to go through to just write his music. What was his daily life like? And I took in, for example, I have a little 18th century inkwell, and I made some quill pens, and I took it in and just set it on the podium and didn't mention it until the very end. I was talking about the St. Matthew Passion, and I said, now, you're going to go upstairs now to the concert hall, and you're going to hear this great work written for two choruses and two orchestras and a bunch of soloists and unusual instruments, and it's going to last about 3 hours. And I picked up one of the quill pens, and I said, every note you hear was written with one of these. And I saw the look in people's eye, because show and tell is better than tell. I could have said, every note you hear was written by with a quill pen or something, and people imagine the quill pen in the high school play, which is a long ostrich quill giant
right
thing.
Right.
And the quill pens that Bach was using and buying in bulk were just feathers out of the left-hand wing of the goose. It's the left-hand wing because that's the one that curls away from the right-handed writer's arm.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, all this crazy little trivia.
So if you were left-handed, you'd have to get a quill from the other side of the goose.
That's correct. Yes. if you look at a quill, if you look at a feather, a goose feather, this is the main feather from the wing of the goose, and it curves in a certain way. And so you want it to kind of curve away from you. And when I began to use props like this, or a fake candle that I had made to look like a candle that would have been used in 1720s, I saw the glow in people's eyes that this was fascinating to them. And I believe that it brings us closer to Bach as a human being, sure, instead of just the marble bust on the music teacher's piano. And of course, people began to say, well, have you written this down? Have you written about this? So I began to do some research into daily life. And one of the first things I did was to buy a wonderful book called Evening's Empire, which is a story of conquering the night with artificial illumination. It's a history of artificial illumination. And,
really?
And that led me to the realization of how utterly, mind-bogglingly primitive interior home lighting was in Bach's time. Staggeringly surprising that nothing had changed in terms of artificial illumination for thousands of years.
Right.
They were still heating, they're not heating, they were still lighting their homes the way the Egyptians had lit their homes 2,500 years before. And that set me on the trail. I thought I need to learn more about this. I knew a lot about Bach. There's a lot of vignettes in my book of his career. And most of them are vignettes that Bach aficionados are familiar with. But in between, in the book, I don't discuss any of his music. I talk about his career as a musician. And in between, what was life like back then? And the lighting was more than anything what did it for me. And the more I got into it, the more I realized that no one had ever actually written a book exactly like this, which is a book about Bach, but discussing, focusing really on the daily life during his era. And that's a subject that really interests me. I began to share bits and pieces of what I was writing with the lecture audiences, and I saw their enthusiasm. But basically, the bottom line is what motivated me was the glow in people's eyes when I talked about daily life in Bach's time. It's 300 years ago. I mean, this is the year of the St. John Passion. It was premiered in April 300 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's a long time. How do we reach over? How do we bridge over those decades, over those centuries, and meet Johann Sebastian Bach as a career man, an employee? He was an employee all his life. He was not a superstar. He was not wealthy. He always worked for a salary. He had a large family, which a lot of people know very well. We're aware of his 20 children. The details of the lives of the 20 children are filled with tragedy because so many of them died at an early age.
Right.
What was that like? How did they do the laundry? What did they eat? And the more I delved into it, the more fascinated I became. And my wife, Jenna, says that I suffer from something she calls research rapture, which is I don't want the research to end, because I figured just around the corner, if I just look up this little fragment, I'm going to learn something else. And this book for me, and in my life as a performer and lecturer, I like to find these aha things. I think, oh wow, I didn't know that. That expands my awareness in some way. And then the very next thing is I want to tell that to other people. I like sharing that. I like sharing things that are a little surprising. And in this case, bringing us closer to the humanity of a composer who has been so important to me in my musical life.
We're talking to author and tenor and research rat, David Gordon. More in just a moment. I'm Ron Clem. This is Bach Talk. You talked a little bit about some of the context where Bach lived and his what things were like around him. Tell us a little bit about where he lived. Tell us a little bit about the Leipzig of Bach's day. This was a bustling place, wasn't it?
Right. Leipzig was at the intersection of two ancient Roman trade routes. And from the get-go, Leipzig had been a major trade center. And there were big trade fairs there every year, the merchandise flowing north and south and east and west. And when Bach was there, it was a pretty bustling town of about 30,000 people.
Wow.
It was and is a beautiful walled city.
It is.
With wide boulevards and wide streets outside the city gates and beer gardens and beautiful villas. It was a very busy city. It had around a dozen churches, including the big main churches that Bach was responsible for managing the music in. And it was a thriving city because of all the trade. And it was also a very progressive city. It was one of the first cities to try out streetlights in the second decade of the 18th century. They were weak, but they were there, and they changed. The streetlights changed Europe, and it changed the world, because it meant that people could go out at night. It meant they could gather in the burgeoning coffee houses, and there were large, we call them coffee houses now, but they were really restaurants that served wine and beer and sold cigars and sold coffee. So Leipzig was a busy town. Bach had a lot of jobs there. He was in charge of the churches, four churches, two of which he had to deal with personally. He taught music in this boys' choir school. It was a boarding school for boys, and those boys supplied the tenor and alto voices for the church music making. And the school was a big building, a five-story building. And Bach's home was one-third of that building, from the basement to the attic. And his home was always bustling and filled with people. A lot of people lived in the Bach household. His two oldest daughters, who were unmarried, lived with them, with Bach and Anna Magdalena, their entire life. Anna Magdalena's sister lived with them. There were always students and other guests there. It was a busy time. And the town itself was as modern as you could be in the 1720s. There was a river running by, and they built water wheels and pumps on the edge of the river to pump water through the town. And that pumped water to these various fountains where people would go and collect water and bring it back to their kitchens and boil it before they drank it. It also enabled them to pump water through the storm gutters where people threw all their detritus, their garbage, and their human waste. I have some photos in the book where you can see these storm gutters in these broad plazas. You can see these gutters flowing through, and people have built little bridges over them to walk over them because they would have been filled with the foulest of stuff. And but
stank to high heaven, I'll bet.
Really, yes. the smell of city living was overpowering back then.
Yeah.
Travelers used to say they could smell Paris before they could see it as they approached the city. And so Leipzig was a little bit progressive in that way.
Yeah.
In that you didn't dare drink the water out of the river because all the effluents from these storm gutters were pumping into the river, and the people downstream were having polluted water just as probably was being pumped into the same coming from upstream from Leipzig. But it was possible for Anna Magdalena to go out, or one of her daughters or the housemaid they had, to go to the fountain, bring back buckets of water, carry them upstairs to the kitchen, which is on the second floor, and boil it. That's why a lot of people drank beer. They drank beer all the time, a weak form of beer, because the brewing process killed the microbes in the water.
Sure.
And everybody drank beer of every age. There were kegs of beer in the basement of the boys' school so that the boys could have their ration of beer every day. You didn't drink the water. So it was a busy town. There were a lot of coffee houses and bars. Bach, for 15 years, ran the sort of the Palm Court Orchestra in Zimmermann's Coffee House. Every Friday night, they had concerts there. A lot of his secular works and concertos were premiered there. He was in charge of all the civic music for funerals and court occasions. And when the Elector of Saxony, who was the closest thing to a king, came to visit, there was all sorts of celebrations. And Bach was in charge of all of that. He was a music contractor. He was a school teacher. Oh, he didn't like to teach school. He was the choir director. He hired other people to teach Latin. He was supposed to teach Latin to the kids, and he hired other people. The city council didn't care for that so much. The city council didn't think too much of him.
No.
I think as great people are, he was demanding, and he had high standards, and he didn't want to be bothered with teaching Latin and theology to the students. He wanted time to compose. He hired assistants to do the classroom teaching. He directed the boys and trained them in their singing and managed music in four churches, two of which he had to be present for personally.
Right.
And it was a job to which duties had accrued over the years without any thought for whether or not one person could do it.
Right.
And he was a very, very busy man there, and it was a very busy city, and he was a big shot because he was one of the leading musicians of the town.
Now, you talked about how the city didn't like him for this or that or whatever reason. And then we're talking about all his church work. And somebody's listening to this and going, well, wait a minute. What's the town got to do with the work in the church? But in those days, there was no separation of church and state, was there?
No. The city council paid him to manage the music in the churches. There was no separation between the two. The churches were part of the city. They were part of the civic life of the city. The churches, the St. Nicholas and St. Thomas Church, which were his principal churches, each seated more than 1,000 people. They were big churches. They're not little tiny chapels.
No.
And he was hired. He was probably one of the greatest keyboard artists of his time, But he had no organ duties in the churches. He was the director of music, which means he led the music, but was not the organist in those churches. And he, as he produced, he had to produce music every week for choir and orchestra in one of the two main churches, and then have choir music in the other churches. And then there were two lesser churches, and those operated with his, under his authority, but without his direct supervision. Yep. It was usually just a few singers to lead the hymns.
Right.
But there was no separation between church and state as we understand it. He had a series of jobs in his life, working either for the city council, which meant he was working in churches, or working for royalty. He worked for the Dukes of Weimar. He worked for the Prince of Köthen. And the other jobs were all church jobs, and he was paid by the city council in a combination. In Leipzig, he was paid a combination of cash and bushels of grain and firewood and beer.
And housing.
And housing. And housing, yes, exactly. So the church job was a civic job. He was, his official title was director of music of the city of Leipzig.
I want to talk more about that. We have to take another quick break. I'm going to head out a minute and go over to Zimmermann's for a brew.
Yeah.
Do you want anything? I'll
yes,
get you
please.
Some. Oh, okay.
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, don't drink the water. That's that's David Gordon. I'm Ron Klem. This is Bach Talk. You start talking about these kinds of things, and immediately you make comparisons, fair or unfair. I had cataract surgery, for example, a couple of years ago, and I was just amazed at how what they're able to do—just miraculous techniques and so on—and I was fine in just a couple of days. Bach had cataract surgery. And I don't know. I mean, it blinded him or killed him or what? You tell me.
Yes. There was this semi-quack English doctor who traveled Europe, never staying in one place too long because he had to leave town
before they chased him
failures,
out. Yeah, right, exactly.
Before they chased him out.
Right.
And his name was Taylor. And he came to Leipzig in the spring of 1750, when Bach was 65 years old, and gave his big spiel before the town council about how great he was and all the accomplishments, which mostly were false.
Sure.
And Bach had Bach was suffering from cataracts and was losing his eyesight. He may already have had a minor stroke, but his health was really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chevalier Taylor, as he billed himself, performed the operations in his coach in the street. And he had an assistant, and the main job qualification for being the assistant of an eye doctor in those days, or a dentist, was upper body strength, so that you could hold the patient still while this procedure went on. I touch on the operation a little bit in the book. And it was something horrible. It was something that it's something that's gruesome, that it's hard to take it in. And Bach was essentially blinded. There was some initial clarity, and then the vision faded. There was a follow-up operation that was supposed to take away scar tissue, which probably made things worse. And his health declined until he was blind. And on the 28th of July of 1750, he passed away, lying in his bed in a darkened room, and where he had been dictating changes in a four-part hymn to his son-in-law. As a footnote, a tragically poetic footnote, just a few years later, the same quack doctor performed the same operation on George Friedrich Handel and blinded him too.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
The truth is crazier than fiction.
It really is. And I, as a researcher, I love that.
Yeah.
I love being surprised, even if it means that I have to think differently about something that I thought I already knew.
There's so much to talk about, and we want to have you back and talk some more about it. But let me just spin out of what you just said. With all the research that you've done, what is it? Research rapture? Is that what? Is that
research. What? Yes, research rapture.
Rapture.
Yes.
What exactly. is the most surprising thing that you learned? What is the thing that shocked you the most in going through all of this?
I believe the most shocking area in general, I mean, the history of lighting was surprising to me.
Yeah.
But it didn't gross me out. But what passed for personal hygiene and cleanliness in the early 1700s in Europe is almost beyond belief.
Yeah, it defies logic, doesn't it?
Yeah, because the Romans early on had it pretty much figured out. There was a history of cleanliness there. There were the baths. There was various types of running water. And when the Romans had their footprint in Germanic Europe, there were communal baths and there was cleanliness was a thing. After the Black Death, after the plague, because people had no idea where disease came from, and it was thought that the plague was transmitted through this miasma that was this ineffable substance in the air that would enter your body through the pores in your skin. Therefore, keep your skin pores clogged and you'll stay healthy.
Oh, geez.
And Europe stopped bathing.
Oh, man.
Yeah, oh, man.
Oh, unbelievable.
And the one thing we don't get with the fabulous miniseries and movies that depict life in the 18th century is we don't get the smell.
No.
We don't get
thankfully.
How bad everything smelled.
Right.
And we don't get how this affected everything, including people's health.
Sure.
And I think that to me was the most surprising thing was, and I never thought as a professional musician and a specialist in the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, that I'd be writing a book about Bach and finding the most fabulous and most interesting research sources to be books like The Dirt on Clean, A History of Cleanliness. Or my favorite was called Privies and WCs, Crapping at the Opera, in Handel's London. And it started out as a doctoral thesis and became a published book. And it's basically a book about how the big opera houses dealt with restrooms or the lack thereof. And for us as 20th century people with hot and cold running water, we have a beautiful tiled shower and I take it so for granted until I read about what people went through then. Bathing maybe every few months, if that. Checking for fleas all the time. And I think that to me, I frankly could have gone farther into it in the book. It would have monopolized the book because it is the most dramatic part of the story, is how far we have come in just a couple of hundred years into something totally and completely different.
Well, on behalf of everyone who's read the book, I thank you for sparing us that
pain.
Yeah, ignorance was not bliss in that case.
No.
Knowing what you know, let me end with this. Knowing what you know and living in a 21st century world, what is today still the greatest misconception about Bach? What is it that we just still don't quite get?
I think there might be a tendency to see Bach as a dour, stern, solemn person. And I think he was very serious about his art. There's no doubt about that. He was very serious about his religious beliefs. He was a devout Lutheran. But he also was a fun-loving person. And he loved to make jokes. He loved to write music that is not so slap-your-knee funny to us today, but it was pretty funny back then. I will also point out that he was a lusty man who had 20 children. And all of this paints for me a picture of someone who really loved life, who really lived life to the fullest, ran a busy household with lots of people, was constantly innovating and writing music in new ways. And so they're part of the myth of Bach is that he was an old conservative. No, he was actually very forward thinking. And he wanted to be upwardly mobile. He wanted to be a success. But at the same time, as his oldest son said, my father's love of his family was so great that he couldn't neglect them and go on to be the kind of success that he might have been.
Wow.
I also realized that Anna Magdalena was his second wife. And when they met, she had a career as a professional singer. And in marrying him, she gave up that career. She had no children of her own. It was her first marriage. He already had 4 children. He was a difficult man with 4 kids to bring up. She must have loved him. And there must have been something there to love. So I think that my impression of Bach from this long distance is that he was a genius of very high standards, and they're hard to live with. She loved him. He would never have had the career he had without her. He loved life. He loved to laugh. He wrote the poem about putting tobacco in his pipe and puffing it. He was a person of vitality and not some stern, dour schoolmaster. And that's what I hope to continue to preach in my own work, is that Bach was a person of great personality, and so is his music.
I am always thrilled to talk to you because you always give such great insights and put things in perspective, and we appreciate you so much. So thank you for spending time with us and talking about some of these things, and I hope you'll come back because I've got about 17 cards here that we didn't get to and talk about some more things.
I'd be glad to come back anytime. I treasure my relationship with the Bach Society of St. Louis. In 1972, after coming back from studying in Canada, I made my American concert debut as tenor soloist with the Bach Society of St. Louis at Powell Symphony Hall. And so to come this full circle from that green beginner more than 50 years ago now to talking with you here, I just love it. I love my association with the Bach Society, and I'm really happy to talk with you any old time, Ron.
So schnell ein Rauchen Wasser. As swiftly as roaring water rushes by, so hurry by the days of our life. Can you relate? The tenor aria from Bach's Cantata 26, David Gordon, in a private recording he made with a student and faculty chamber ensemble from Princeton University. Remember now, you can order your own copy of The Little Bach Book by David Gordon by simply going to our website, bachsociety.org, click on About, and you'll find the link. For slightly more than a cup of coffee at Zimmermann's, you can enjoy The Little Bach Book. For more information about David Gordon, his past recordings, his current endeavors, visit his website, spiritsound.com. One word, spiritsound.com. In addition to David's music, we also heard from pianist Sandra Geary and the Bach Society Orchestra conducted by music director Aidan Asparger. Our associate producer is Scott McDonald. Marketing and technical assistance provided by Andy Murphy and Carissa Marciniak of The Right Relations. Subscribe to Bach Talk wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more at bachsociety.org. Bach Talk is a registered trademark of the Bach Society of St. Louis. I'm Ron Clem.